Well, welcome to the Happy Habit Podcast, Tamira. Delighted that you could make the time this morning or this afternoon where you are in Perth in Australia. Mira is a resilience and embodiment coach who has been practicing yoga for all of a quarter of a century and teaching yoga too and body-based therapy for the last decade. She's completed studies in linguistics and journalism, also holds an MBA and is super busy because she's currently completing a master's in counselling at Notre Dame University. Now, people seek out Mira from all over the world when they are burnt out or feeling stuck with their traditional therapies, and Mira teaches them ways to develop routines and rituals for embodied resilience that help them work through unresolved traumas, to help them deal with challenges and stresses in their lives. And I mentioned resilience there, Mira. It's resilience I'm really interested to talk to you about today. Can we first of all define exactly what resilience is?
For sure. The way that I use it with my clients is really, because I come through a trauma lens, is really about developing sufficient amount of resources to meet the stresses of one's life. So I often think about it as this bridge, and the stresses are like things getting stacked upon that bridge, and more stress is coming upon that bridge. If there's too much stress, the bridge collapses and we have trauma. What we then need to do with resilience is building those fortifications underneath the bridge to keep it strong so that it can flex and meet the demands of stress as they go up and down, as anyone's life does.
And this is something, actually, I looked at some of your videos, and resilience is something you had to draw upon in recent months, because I believe that a lot of your social media platforms were hacked, and you mentioned this in one of your videos. So resilience was something that you had to draw upon. You had to draw upon your training in order to be able to overcome that challenge for yourself.
Yes. Yeah. It was about 9 months ago, everything. My Facebook page, all my business pages, profiles were hacked. They attempted to steal money, which I did get back, thankfully, but I couldn't get my accounts back. A lot of time and energy and conversation with social media, customer relations, mm-hmm. or customer non-relations is what I called it in my experience. And it was really painful, but a really amazing experience to walk the talk and rebuild things. And, you know, our conversation is evidence of that fact, that that's kind of how we've come to know each other.
Well, exactly. And talking of resilience, again, drawing on some of your social media videos, you mention an important thing, three R's. Can you talk about what those three R's that are so central to what resilience is?
Regulate, recover, and reset. So really, a lot of people, if there's been trauma to build resilience, if there's been trauma, then that capacity to regulate may have been interrupted. So the nervous system has probably got some stuck energy in it or something, or there's developmental traumas that haven't allowed people to really know that, oh, how I feel is okay. And then to have that safety container around that so that it can be held, experienced, processed, and used. You know, our emotional information is useful when we can deal with it effectively. So when we learn to regulate, we learn to understand what's going on. Oh, my nervous system thinks something is happening, you know, but my adult self can see what's actually really happening. And because I know how my nervous system works, I can give it what it needs. So that might be a rest, or it might be a deep breath, or it might be some sound, or it might be a walk in nature, all of those things. But we do it with great intention to nourish and rebuild, there's another R, the nervous system. Allowing yourself that time to recover, to have naps, to allow the nervous system to come back into balance. And then resetting, this is really vital in terms of resilience, right? So people might go, oh, I've met that experience that spiked my nervous system. And I really see stress and trauma similarly. So people, if they don't relate to the experience of trauma or working through trauma, you can just think about this in terms of your day-to-day stresses. I've met that stress. My boss was angry with me. Most of the time, some kind of trauma gets activated. They're just not aware of it. It's in the background. And then maybe you've managed to regulate. So you've brought your nervous system back into balance. Maybe you've managed to recover, have that rest, do that thing. The reset is really important to tell yourself, that was okay that that thing happened. And now I'm going to come back and start again, or I'm going to meet that challenge. And that step gets missed for a lot of people. Okay, I learned to regulate and then I have the rest, and then I just give up and I give that thing away, or I go in a different direction. So the resilience is what allows us, if we're really wanting to go after, you know, kind of big, bold, bright, audacious lives, to be persistent. And that persistence is going to require resilience. And anything big, you know, which you would know from, I saw How to Listen to Your Podcast, beautiful work, and, you know, been going for a long time and lots of episodes, that requires, I imagine, that you do this, you know, in some form. Most people are doing it in some form or another, but they might just have different language for it, or they don't have that kind of conscious awareness. But given what you're doing, I imagine you do.
These three R's, the regulate, the recover, and the reset, I imagine that combined together, the effect of those is that they essentially tether us. Would that be correct?
That's a beautiful word. It's funny that you use that word, Matthew, because I don't know. Are you familiar with the polyvagal system?
I wanted to ask you about that later on, but sir, introduce it now, no problem.
Okay, so the idea of the polyvagal system is really centering around understanding different complexes of the nervous system relating to different aspects of the vagus nerve and what the vagus nerve might be doing to either go into a protective state, fight, flight, or freeze, and those are two different things, or being in a relaxed, parasympathetic, open, connected state.
Should we just define first of all what the vagus nerve is, then, and then the difference, but the difference then between the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system, to people out there who haven't heard those terms before, just the basic terms, if we could.
Not nervous system nerds? Yes. Yeah. No problem. Okay, so the vagus nerve is the biggest nerve in the body, and it runs from the brainstem down through the heart, right down into the guts, and runs up into the face as well. The vagus nerve lives in the parasympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system. This is the automatic responses of our system. So the parasympathetic branch is the part that allows us to go down and relax and go slow and all of those kind of functions of the body. The sympathetic nervous system branch of the autonomic, i.e. automatic system, actually sits, you know, outside of the vagus nerve and is the fight flight response. It's that kind of, but the vagus nerve does interrelate with that. I won't go too technically into mm-hmm. that, but is that kind of simple enough? Or?
That's perfect. Just so as that people get that distinction and they can relate to, okay, fight flight. Yes, I can relate to that. And then the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the kind of the rest and digest aspect of the nervous system. Yeah.
Thank you. I've been talking in these terms for so many years. You know, you begin to take them for granted. So I appreciate you pausing to do that. And they're so useful, you know, if I can redefine them for people that they can actually use them. So with the polyvagal, looking at how the vagus nerve interrelates and helps us to regulate, there is a phrase, coming back to our original part of the questions, that is to be tethered in your ventral vagal state. So the ventral vagal is the upper aspect between, you know, heart, brainstem, and face that shows us. So the face gets relaxed, the eyes get relaxed, there's a smile, there's a soft tone in the voice. And these are all indicators of safety. These are what we use to co-regulate, you know, our nervous system with other people. So when we want to have other experiences that maybe have droplets of these different states. So the depth of the, kind of trying to think about how I might say it, of the vagus nerve state being dorsal vagal, which is the freeze state, we might actually want an aspect of dorsal vagal, but we want to stay tethered. We don't want to go right down into that state because the experience of that state is shut down, stop doing anything, you know, the world is a dark and scary place and I'm powerless. So we don't want to be that deep in that, but we want to be able to relax, you know, so we stay tethered in that sense of safety, in that sense of expansion and connection with others, and allow some of that energy in. Or we might want to play, and that's a little bit of a blend of the ventral vagal safety with the mobilizing energy of the sympathetic. So we stay tethered, but we allow ourselves to move flexibly. A healthy nervous system is a flexible nervous system, not one that's rigidly stuck anywhere, but allows you to meet the moment appropriately.
So are we able to manipulate our nervous system then whenever we're talking about resilience, for example? Are we able to tap into our ability to use our nervous system to armor us in a moment when we need to express resilience?
100%. I saw that are you still doing triathlons and things like that? Yeah. So I can imagine you're well familiar. So for me, where I really used it to great effect in that sense was when I was coming into performing. So I'd been playing music for a long, 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 long time. Actually, I lived in Ireland for a while. So
I had
Irish inspiration.
And whereabouts in Ireland did you live?
I was in County Clare.
Oh, lovely part of the world. Lovely.
Absolutely nice. Beautiful. And back in the day, I hitchhiked all the way up the West Coast, and I used to stop in at all the local pubs and local towns. This is a long time ago. Don't try this at home, kids. And watch the sessions. And the way that, you know, Frank and from the local butcher and Mary from the local supermarket or post office would walk in, everyone would go quiet, they'd pick up an instrument or start singing, everyone pays attention, and they're just so relaxed. It's so integrated into the culture. It was absolutely revolutionary for me and inspirational. I had that in my mind. I was like, I want to be able to do that one day. You know, I'm sitting there frozen, like I can't, even though I've been playing music my whole life, I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't.
Everybody here is very relaxed, constantly tapping or using music to tap into that parasympathetic nervous response. I think that's what it is, so.
Right? Exactly. Exactly. And that's a beautiful point that you raise, because music in and of itself has, like, there are three main aspects that I would say are really easily accessible to influence the nervous system and bring you back into regulated states, which is movement, breath, and sound. And all three get involved when you're playing music. So for me, I was trying to get the courage. So that sense of, I probably wouldn't use that exact term of armoring up in terms of the resilience and the courage, because I think that's what's actually caused the fragility, is that for many people is having trauma then creates armored patterns of rigidity,
right?
And we're looking for flexibility. So to build that, you know, I always think about the bamboo image, you know, it's so able to move with the wind, but it's very strong. And that's the kind of feeling we want in the nervous system. So there are things that you can do on all those levels that I just mentioned, and I would do them. So I would step up on the stage and I might have a particular breathing pattern. I might talk to myself in a particular way. The key, one of the things, Matthew, that I find so radical about the polyvagal theory is the awareness that it brings and the self-compassion that it automatically brings, because you're able to say to yourself, oh, this is meant to be happening. My nervous system thinks I'm under threat. Fair enough. 50 people are staring at me and I'm by myself on a stage. The fact that my system thinks that that's a little bit scary and exposing and vulnerable, fair enough. This is meant to be happening. The minute that you give yourself that frame, there's a shift. The nervous system goes, oh, okay, you're not fighting me. And you become friends with the nervous system. Thank you for trying to keep me safe. You know, that's even an affirmation that I'll work with and teach clients. The first thing when the body is starting to feel dysregulated, rather than have another reaction of, oh no, what's happening? And this is, oh my God, I always get so nervous and that's so crap. Oh, thank you, nervous system, for trying to keep me safe. Then we might breathe. Then we might do some physical movements like hugging the body and really getting a sense of where I am in time and space. All there are infinite numbers of these tools that we can intervene with that will then allow the nervous system, once you've cognitively registered, yes, you've been protecting me, but actually I'm safe and we want to do this, then we can physically bring the nervous system on board with us through some of these tools.
I've spoken about this before on this podcast about the fact that whenever we were in school, for example, as children, we're never taught about resilience, and we're never taught how to communicate to ourselves in very difficult situations. And it's our response, our poor response normally to difficult situations and challenges that makes that challenge even worse. We become our own worst enemies because we're in a situation whereby we are, as you say, we're on stage and we sense it as a threat. And then we sabotage our own performance then because we think we're at risk. But if we're educated, and this is what you're talking about, educating ourselves and creating a dialogue with ourselves, a dialogue of compassion, well, then we allow ourselves then to thrive. And would you agree with that?
I would completely agree with that, Matthew. I think that was beautifully said, that absolutely when we can be taught how to have that dialogue with ourselves and to understand it compassionately, that we are primarily biological beings as human beings. You know, we're spiritual beings, whatever you believe, we're, you know, natural, spiritual or intellectual, all these different things, but we are very much, I believe, controlled by our nervous system first. You know, a neuron travels, I think it's like 437 miles an hour or something. It's, you know, it's before you've got a cognitive thought going, your nervous system has registered. So now we have the beauty of neuroscience to teach us these things. And absolutely, even back then, we had many people who were starting to wake up and realize the way you talk to yourself makes a difference, you know. And now there's a validity coming to that because scientists can actually show you, well, here's the impact on your cells. Here's what happens to your nervous system when you talk to yourself that way or when you talk to yourself this way. Understanding resilience and having it as something, I wanted to touch on the self-sabotage aspect that comes. Yeah, there's a collapse response happening, you know, like you said, we'll meet the difficulty, and then in the face of that difficulty to protect, we'll collapse. And we're not taught when we're young how to move through that. Absolutely. And then we become, unfortunately, we do become weak. And that is not a great position to be in.
And this is where then coping mechanisms, unhealthy coping mechanisms will come in then, because to deal with a situation we're uncomfortable with, we'll resort then to, well, unhealthy activities like addictions, etc.
Yes. And I mean, I think a lot of that is related again back to what I was talking about in the beginning with the trauma, that the intensity of that discomfort when you've had trauma gets pretty big. And so the pain inside, but even the pain, you're absolutely right. I'm just kind of thinking as I'm listening to you about applying it a little bit differently. The pain of disappointment is something that's very difficult to deal with. And if you're not taught what we're talking about, you don't want to feel that. Certainly a kid doesn't want to feel that. I still don't want to feel that, you know, as a fully grown adult. It's an uncomfortable feeling. And so if we're not taught, all these processes and models of like, oh, it's okay that I had that experience and it doesn't mean what I think, you know, it's meaning, the fact that this happened in my nervous system is okay, then we will escape pain because that's normal, that's human to try and get away from it. And we will turn, yes, to numbing through whatever particular quick pain relieving strategy it might be. For me personally, it was overworking. I would like work so hard, I would be numb and I would be adrenalized and couldn't feel the pain. For some people, it'll be a substance addiction. We know social media, shopping, gambling, all sorts of ways that can happen.
So to bring it back then to resilience again, let's say somebody right now who's listening to this podcast is feeling that they are struggling because they are finding it difficult in whatever challenge that they're meeting at the moment, and their resilience is really suffering. How do they tap into their inner reserves of resilience? What basic things can they do? Over and above, obviously, going to see somebody or talking with somebody like yourself. But in the moment, what can they do to tap into their own resilience reserves?
The first thing is the self-acceptance and self-compassion. You named it before. Like, without that, you can't move forward into anything. So if someone's trying to work on a project, and it could be anything, it could be a creative project, or it could be, a physical project, it could be changing careers or making changes in their relationship, the first thing has to be that self-talk. That'll be the quickest way, without getting a bit of extra training, understanding that there is nothing wrong with you is the key to then starting to build the skills and resources that you need to really become sufficiently resilient to the specific challenge that you're working on. But if you think there's something wrong with you from the beginning, there's nowhere to go from there.
And also with that, though, there will be people out there who have a very conflicted relationship with themselves. So in this instance, then, that process could also involve self-forgiveness.
Beautifully identified. Yes. Depending, like, you know, I work a lot on an individual level, so everybody is slightly different. But frequently in the early stages, yes, because there might be a lot of shame, there might be a lot of judgment about the so-called failures up until that point. And so to get to that point, but in a way, I guess I see it as once you understand, really deeply understand and embody and befriend the nervous system, there's not really anything to forgive yourself for. This is the beauty of that transformation. There's nothing wrong. Your body, your system makes complete sense. Everything that you did makes complete sense. When you understand these things, when you begin to go, oh yeah, my nervous system was in a protective mode, probably went into an inner child state, I used old coping strategies because I never learned the good ones, as we talked about before. And then it's more like, oh, I'm okay, you know, and really developing that first sense of connection with there's nothing wrong. I'm not broken. Who I am makes sense. How do I work with this? That's the next step.
Okay, so once our dialogue with ourselves is healthier and comes from a good place and we treat ourselves more kindly, also as far as resilience is concerned, as I said, to somebody who's listening right now, breath work, is that something that someone can do in the moment in order to get control of those emotions that you and that nervous energy that you were talking about a second ago?
Yeah, so Stephen Porges, the academic who created the polyvagal theory, and all of the research shows, now everybody's different. Again, it'll depend on your experience. And for some people, breath is not as effective. But generally speaking, statistically speaking, breath is the fastest way to regulate the nervous system. Breath will allow you to regulate that vagus nerve, which will regulate the vagal break and regulate your heart rate and your heart rate variability, which I imagine you're all over with what you do. And so learning to have that more resilient, like physically embodied resilience. So the breath, and for people just starting out, like if there's one thing, it's just do that. It's become really popular. So I hope people know the box breathing, you know, breathe in for four, breathe out for six, and you will start to calm down, you know, and just be aware of the breath going in and out. Make your exhales a little longer than the inhales. This will help to activate parasympathetic responses in the body and just calm you down.
At the moment, it seems as if meditation is a huge thing, so we can incorporate the breath work into meditation, and it doesn't have to be even for 20 minutes. It could be for a short period of time as 5 minutes, isn't that right?
Absolutely. So when I first trained as a meditation teacher, my teacher, it's a local guy in Perth in Western Australia where I live, he used to introduce people. He worked as a corporate meditation consultant. So he went out and was teaching very stressed out executives how to meditate. And initially it would be 2 minutes. You know, he'd be like, Mira, when you're trying to get people in the chair and just being able to sit still for a minute, don't hold them there longer than 2 minutes. Like that's all they're going to cope with. Interestingly, with the people I work with, I found people that have that kind of agitated experience, I can usually, about 7 minutes is good to be long enough that they can tolerate, or sorry, short enough that they can tolerate, but long enough that they actually start to feel that shift that comes when you meditate, you know? So if it's really short, you'll start to calm down, but if you can hang in there 7 minutes, you'll start to get that spaciousness open up.
Would you be somebody who would, whenever you're meditating, would you meditate just focusing on your breath, or would you encourage people to use, let's say, music also in the background? Because you can avail of guided meditations, no problem. But personally, I find that for me, if I want to utilize meditation and practice meditation, that it's best for me to rely on something that I bring with me everywhere, and that is my breath. I don't always have access to music or guided meditations. How do you feel about that?
It's a great point. I was getting excited when you raised it, and I have so many opinions and perspectives because I've been meditating a long time and through different traditions. The two things that I thought of were that same meditation used to talk about, again, everybody's different, and there's a beauty in that you can experiment with. And he used to talk about people who were moving mind meditators and still mind meditators. And this was still only using the resources that you have. So a moving mind meditator might do a body scan because it allows them to stay focused but move. A still mind meditator might just be able to observe the breath go in and out. If you have extreme trauma, major dysregulation in the nervous system, you may not be able to tolerate silence and focusing. It might trigger rumination. So it depends. For people in that instance, a mantra might be better. So there's actually something going on in the head to take up that space that otherwise negative thoughts will come into. I also believe in the beginning, I'm super pragmatic. Whatever gets you meditating, do it. You know, and then start to explore whatever allows you to start to build in those little droplets of building a habit. Do it and then start exploring. Oh, I prefer this way. And you're absolutely right. Everyone's got access to a breath.
Exactly. And I think what a lot of people also who haven't meditated before don't realize is that I've heard people refer to this, oh, meditation is about clearing the mind. And I always say to people, that's not the case. You're always going to think thoughts because the brain's function is to think thoughts. Your function in meditation, and you can contradict me on this if you wish, is to observe the thoughts, but don't judge them. Just let them move on because your brain is going to think anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really big misconception that a lot of meditators are trying to correct. Wherever, I don't know where it came from, you know, because I studied Zen meditation with the Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh, and there was never a clear your mind. It was just be in the moment. So you just observe what's there. Well, there's a thought there. Oh, okay. And then you're able to go deeper. Oh, there's a breath there, but I'm not going to stay attached to that thought. I'm not going to get drowned in that thought or float off in that thought. So I don't know where I am in the present moment. And I'd forgotten that I'm even breathing and that I'm sitting on the floor on this cushion. So if you try to push thoughts away, then you're just thinking more, you know, and you're in, again, like we talked about before, you're not in a friendly relationship with yourself, which is the key to all of this practice, all of this stuff is how do I establish a friendly relationship with the self is going to build resilience over time automatically by how you're treating yourself and then how that manifests in behaviors. So for me, yeah, that's, and again, thank you, beautiful brain. Thank you, beautiful attention, for trying to jump all over the place and protect me and keep me safe, which is your job. Now we're going to hang out here with my breath.
Terrific. Well, it's great that you brought it back to resilience again. And that's where we started in this discussion today. I could talk with you for hours. I know you're such a busy lady, and you're a mind of information. I can tell that it's a subject that you're super passionate about too. So how can people get in contact with you, Mira?
Yeah, so my website, you'll put all the links in, I assume.
Sure.
So like you did, there's a contact form on my website, which is my name, mirarao.com.au, and people are welcome to contact me there. It's great to get hold of me on the socials. So Facebook, Instagram, I'm really trying to be a force for good on a platform that's quite challenging for many people's mental health. So I try to go on there and share all of what you and I are talking about. That's it. That's all you'll find on there from me. So you can friend me on Facebook. You can follow my business page. It's all just my name. If you search my name anywhere, it will come up. Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And the reason I say that is someone might be a bit shy to reach out directly to me. They can just watch a video, have a listen to some of the information. And then if they do want to ask a question and have a conversation, they can just write me a comment there or DM me.
Well, I'm delighted that you took the time to talk to me today, and we will put all of your details and your contact links in the description for this podcast today. But we'll leave it there, Mira. Thank you so much for talking with me.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks for inviting me, Matthew.